From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Not all war wounds are as obvious as a missing limb, as we've learned from scores of veterans who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. This hour, we'll talk with journalist David Finkel about what he's seen while embedded with troops of the 216 Infantry Battalion in Iraq, and what he observed when they came home to Fort Riley. We'll discuss how these soldiers' experiences reveal the larger problems troops are having readjusting to life outside of war zones, and how they're trying to cope. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. David Finkel's new book is about what happens after war. As one review put it, the book is about soldiers and the anger, anxiety, shame, depression, guilt, sleeplessness, self-abuse, drug abuse, and suicidal tendencies they confront. It's about the shouting matches, crying jags, and bizarre behavior, along with lots of guns and two-pack-a-day smoking habits. Useful therapy? Not a whole lot. We're talking about a veteran with nightmares who sees images of dead Iraqis floating in his bathtub. David Finkel stayed with the soldiers of the 216 Infantry Battalion, whom he chronicled in The Good Soldiers, and wrote about them when they returned home to Fort Riley in the middle of Kansas. His latest book is Thank You for Your Service. David Finkel is a staff writer at The Washington Post. He has covered the wars in Iraq and Kosovo. He's won the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and the Pulitzer Prize. David Finkel, it's an honor to have you here. Welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, Steve. That's quite a description of the book. It sounds like pretty grim stuff, doesn't it?
Well, and it is.
In parts, yes.
In parts, yes. Well, let's begin with numbers, David. You point out that 2 million Americans were sent to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. How many of those suffered mental wounds of one kind or another?
Okay, it's a great question to start with, especially because the book itself is not heavy on numbers. It's not a policy book or an abstract book in any way.
It's not at all.
It's a very ground level view of what's going on. But the numbers do matter, and it's about 2.5 million Americans have joined the services since 9/11. And of the 2.5 million, 2 million or so have been sent directly into Iraq or Afghanistan. And of the 2 million, the best estimates are that about 500,000 have come home with some type of psychological, some type of mental wound from what they've done, what they experienced, what they saw. And so the interesting thing about this number to me is that once again, out of a war, most people have come home okay. That's 1.5 million, if these estimates are to be believed. 1.5 million folks have come home in good shape, but 500,000 haven't.
One in four have not.
Right, right. And I think it's worth paying attention to what it really means to not only the folks themselves, but to American society at large, what life is like for these one in four.
You know, I'm wondering about the men of the 216 Infantry Battalion, who you followed so closely. How readily available was the help, David, that they needed once they got home, mainly to Fort Riley?
Mixed. It's a complicated answer. Some folks would describe when they came home, everyone got the question, are you having bad dreams? Are you having suicidal thoughts? But to many of them, it seemed more like a box-checking exercise. If you say, no, my dreams are fine, I'm not having suicidal thoughts, that was the end of it, and they moved on to the next thing. For these guys who deployed from Fort Riley in 2007 and 2008, it was a 15-month deployment for the part of the war known as the Surge.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they came home and began exhibiting symptoms of PTSD, the anxiety, depression, a couple of attempts at suicide. By then, Fort Riley did have this thing called a Warrior Transition Battalion, which was a special unit set up to help soldiers such as some of these guys make, to get dedicated attention and help make the transition from a wounded state either back into their units or into civilian society. And in theory, this sounds like an awfully good thing, but in practice day to day, it was one more example of how good intentions sometimes come with absurdities and a bit of heartbreak.
You talk, too, about sort of the random nature of the availability of that counseling. How is it random?
Well, so let me give examples of three guys who for anybody who reads this book, they'll be spending a lot of time with these folks. One guy had acted, as far as I'm concerned, heroically in the war. He's the guy I think any of us would like to be in a given situation. He was in a Humvee that was blown up. He had a broken leg. And as the Humvee caught on fire, despite his broken leg, he got out of the Humvee and made his way back and helped pull out two more severely wounded soldiers. But he couldn't get to the driver, who burned to death. And this guy, without telling anyone, began having nightmares. I mean, his dreams weren't about the guys he did save, but about the guy he didn't save. And in the dream, the guy was on fire saying, "Why didn't you save me? And you have this dream enough times." And eventually you crack open a bit, as this guy did, and he needed help. And the help he got was in Topeka, the inpatient PTSD program there. And he got 7 weeks in this program. That was his case.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy, same unit, also came home, cracked open and needed some help, wanted to go to Topeka, but the waiting list was just too long, Steve. So in his case, he ended up in a 4-week program in Colorado. Also a good program, but one is 4 weeks and one is 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third guy, the guy I write about most in this book and readers would spend the most time with.
Adam
Schumann. Mm-hmm. The day came when he also screwed up the courage to say he needed help. Topeka was full. Colorado was full. His caseworker kept looking and looking around, and she finally found this little program in California, donor-supported, which gave them the luxury of inviting guys in to stay as long as they needed to stay, 4 months minimum.
Hmm.
So here's a guy who got 7 weeks. Here's another guy who got 4 weeks. Here's another guy who got what turned into be 5 months. And it's not because one program was better suited to the particular problems of the guy himself. It all depended where the opening was.
And in Adam's case, you make the point that those months he spent in that facility were absolutely pivotal.
Well, I think he would make the case. I think if Adam Schumann were here today and he were asked about this, he would say that program saved his life. He had reached the point. He had been a very, very good soldier. In fact, he had been regarded as the best or among the best soldiers in this battalion. And when I first met Adam while reporting the first book, when I was in Iraq with these guys, he was on his third deployment. He had been in combat for about 1,000 days, and then came the day where, for various reasons, he couldn't do it anymore, and had to go home. And instead of feeling a sense of pride over how well he had served for 1,000 days, he went home cloaked in a sense of guilt that he was leaving the war too soon. And despite attempts to get over it, despite medications, despite occasional dips into therapy, which he didn't quite trust, as so many guys don't, eventually even he realized he needed some help.
They don't trust it in this day and age, David. Why?
Well, I think we see the same thing in civilian society. Psychological wounds, they're still a bit of shame attached to acknowledging that you're not feeling right mentally.
That you're not maybe tough enough.
Well, and it's exaggerated. I think when you're an infantry guy, these are some rough and tough guys. And so many of them afterward said to me, if I could look in the mirror and I could see some physical manifestation of my wounds, if I could see something missing, if I could see some scarred over bullet wounds, or if I had a missing leg or a missing arm, then I'd have such an easier time believing something is wrong with me. But when it's a mental wound, when it's an invisible wound, the stigma runs deep, and so does their own sense of in some cases, guilt over having such an injury. It's a hard thing for them to acknowledge.
Yeah, but David, hearing you describe the treatment for these men, is there's something astonishing to me about it. One guy gets 7 weeks, one guy gets 4 weeks, one guy gets 5 months. That's a range that's all over the map. And these, you would only begin to assume that these men all needed perhaps more than 7 weeks or 4 weeks. That's just amazing to me, the how irregular this treatment schedule
well,
is.
Well, I'm reluctant to characterize one program as better than any of the others. And I think if the folks running the programs were here today, they would talk up why 4 weeks can work, why 7 weeks can work.
Yeah, but come on, 4 weeks to 5 months, though.
Well, there is a difference. And to me, it illustrates both the good intentions and the haphazard nature of a system that's put in place to help these guys. It's great that there's a system. In previous wars, there was nothing. Even guys from Vietnam, choose any war, but as recently as Vietnam, guys came home and there was nothing waiting for them until the mid-70s when the first vet center started, then the late 70s when the very first inpatient residential treatment programs began. This was kind of... Most of these guys came home and they were on their own. Mm-hmm. Now there's a system in place, but even the people in the system would acknowledge being overwhelmed. They would acknowledge the haphazard nature of it and the inconsistencies.
And it's perhaps because one in four of these soldiers are coming back reporting that they need some help. You suspect the number probably is even higher. So bottom line it for me, David, just how prepared is the Veterans Administration for the soldiers coming home? How ready are they to handle this influx of soldiers who are raising their hands now and saying, "I need some help"?
So I don't mean to deflect the question, but what I've tried to do in both of these books is keep any sense of my opinion, my judgment, out of it. These are reflections of the stories of the soldiers themselves in the first book, and the second book is what their families are going through. So my answer has to be contained in the experiences I saw firsthand when I was reporting the book.
And based on that.
And based on that, it's an overwhelmed, inconsistent system that is staffed with all kinds of well-intentioned people who some days go home as exasperated as anyone that they weren't able to do what they want to do because this thing is just so ragged around the edges.
And yet there's so much talk from our politicians that we're going to take care of our returning veterans. You hear it over and over and over again.
Well, sure. And sometimes I think it's helpful, instead of relying on the good words of politicians, to dig into what's happening beyond the words, beyond the policies, beyond the bromides and promises, and see what's going on the ground. And that's well, I like to think that's what both of these books have achieved to some extent.
David Finkel is our guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest book, Thank You for Your Service. You know, this book, Thank You for Your Service, begins its opening pages, David, with this searing look at one soldier, Adam, living out in Fort Riley. And he's returned home. He was, as you pointed out already, a great soldier, a soldier so many looked up to, and now he's home. Tell us a little more about Adam Schumann and why this great soldier suddenly came home.
Well, it goes back to the first book. And when I met Adam, you know, these guys were deployed they were on the ground at Baghdad for about 14 months, it turned out to be. And I was with them for about 8 months, living among them and just watching them go about their soldiering, carrying out the strategy of the surge. And there was a period in there when I was asking around for who was a great soldier, someone I haven't met yet. And one of the junior officers mentioned this guy, Adam Schumann. And a little time went by, but I decided one day to go find Adam. And I walked into his room and saw a rather gaunt, haunted-looking man sitting alone on his bunk, and I introduced myself. And he said, "I guess I know why you're here." And I said, "Well, I'm here to find out what's going on with you." He said, "What's going on with me is I'm leaving the war today." And it just happened
that
to
day.
Be. Yeah. So I stuck around with Adam until he left, as he walked to the helicopters to leave the war. My reporting allowed me to go along with him. And there was this scene in the first book where he's one of maybe six guys in line to get a helicopter out. And when the helicopter lands, the line moves forward until he gets to the front of the line and a hand comes down. And over the noise and the clatter and the dust, a guy screams, "Next one's yours." And Adam didn't quite know what that meant. Everyone left. Now it's just Adam alone waiting for whatever comes in next. And the next set of helicopters have a big red cross on the side. Mm-hmm. And as I write in the book,
yeah,
these were the helicopters for the injured and the dead. And that's when Adam Schumann fully realized who he had become, the injured, the dead, the done. That's who he had become.
Not someone he wanted to be.
Not someone he wanted to be. And he left the war. He left the war early. And that's how we see Adam in the first book. In the second book, which is a sequel to the first, it's the second volume of the story, basically, begins 2 years later. Adam and his wife, Saskia, are in bed. They're in Kansas. It's the middle of the night. They've just had a baby.
And this story is haunting. Yeah.
Saskia asks, she's exhausted, and she asks Adam if he can hold the baby so she can get a little sleep. And he says, "Yeah, I got it." She hands the baby over. She falls asleep. And then this wounded man, for whom so many things have become so problematic, can't help himself. He's tired too, and he closes his eyes. And soon the baby is rolling out of his arms, off his chest, over the side of the bed. Mm. And then the noise of a baby hitting the floor first wakes Saskia, and Saskia scrambling across Adam wakes him up. And their after war is underway in full fury.
And that's almost a precursor to their situation and what's happening, all the struggles they're having. You know,
but what happens in the book, basically, it's the period of time from Adam's first homecoming from the war, which is so troubled, to his second homecoming a couple of years later, when he comes home from this treatment program where he spent 5 months, and it's a better homecoming. So it's really the arc from the first time to the second time.
You know, Saskia is so determined to be patient with her husband. I mean, she just is willing herself to do that, and she struggles and struggles, and then she begins to falter too, as you can only imagine that so many wives wind up doing.
Sure. Saskia is representative of so many strong women out there doing what they can to try to help heal these fractured families. And over time, Saskia, she becomes angrier. She can't help herself. She doesn't like herself for getting angry, but she gets angrier and things become more difficult. And she's someone who's trying so hard, and then at night writing things in her diary like, "I feel like my heart is about to explode."
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to Adam just for a moment, and David, and talk about his decision to leave, how he felt about coming home, and particularly, how did he tell his fellow soldiers that he was on his way out? How did that moment sort of play out? Because you were right there.
Sure, it was right before he left. He called them together.
Running mates here.
He had a little squad. He was running, and they looked up to this guy because most of these guys in this battalion, even though it was that late in the war, as we know, these are wars of multiple deployments. In this case, most of those guys were on their first deployment. They were 19, 18, in some cases 20-year-olds, and they looked up to Adam. And he called them together one day and said, "I'm going home." And here are these kids looking at this guy saying, "What's the deal?" And they said what they could in sort of attempts at sympathy. But he couldn't even hear things clearly at that point, because here's an example. There was a day Adam should have been out, or was supposed to be out on a mission. Had to stay back for a couple of reasons. And another guy went out, took his place, did not see the roadside bomb that Adam probably would have seen, and it went off.
Adam was known for his great eyesight.
Great eyes.
Yeah, saw everything.
And he wasn't there. And the other guy didn't see it. And the bomb went off, and a guy died. And later on, someone said to Adam, none of this would have happened if you were there. And it was meant as a compliment.
But
Adam heard it as an indictment. And it's one of the things that cloaked him in a sense of guilt as he left the war that day. And so did the reaction of his soldiers. You know, they went off on a mission, yeah. And he just stayed there in his room until it was time to get to the helicopters. And on the way, he called his wife, called Saskia, and said, I'm on my way home. And she said, you know, I'm a little worried about what you might do to me. And he said, everything's going to be fine. But he hung up the phone and said, what if she's right? He didn't know either.
Because she senses that something's not right with her husband.
Something's not right.
Something's
and
not right.
What's going to happen when he gets home? And, you know, anybody who's listening to this and they've experienced themselves, they know that what I'm describing, I'm not describing the extremes of behavior here. This is pretty much the norm. What Adam and Saskia and all the people I write about represent aren't the dismissible extremes of a war experience, but rather what's going on coast to coast in so many communities, including ones in Kansas.
You know, we're talking about Adam and his farewell to his fellow soldiers, but he also had experienced in the months prior to that, David, some very difficult moments during the troop surge in Iraq. And one of those moments involved a very close friend of his that he had to carry on his back away from a firefight, a gunfight. Tell us about that moment, because, again, I'm using the word searing, but that moment really sears its way into Adam's consciousness in the years and months to come.
Right. I would like to talk about that. Now, the day this happened, they weren't friends. There's a friendship that came later after they got home. But on this particular day, which was fairly early in the deployment, there was a guy named Michael Emery. Yeah. They were out on a mission, and a guy named Michael Emery was on a rooftop. And a sniper got a clean shot, and the bullet went into Emery's head. And down he went on this rooftop and had to be evacuated. And for various reasons, they were having a hard time getting him on a litter. And there were three flights of stairs to go down. So Schumann put Emery, big old Emery, across his back in a fireman's carry and huffed and puffed his way down these three flights of stairs.
This was not an easy task.
No. Mm-hmm. And what made it so unfortunate, everything made it unfortunate, but one of the things is that, without being too graphic, much of the blood coming out of Michael Emery's head kept draining into Adam Schumann's open mouth as he breathed his way
down the stairs.
And 6 months later, when it was time for Adam to leave the war, he was still tasting that blood. And to this day, you know, of course he still can. It's just, as you said, a searing thing. So that was part of the thing stirring in him and running around his head on the day he left. But what was so heartbreaking, heartwarming to me in the reporting of this new book, there came a day when Michael Emery, who should have been dead but didn't die, who shouldn't walk but walks somewhat, who shouldn't talk but can talk a bit, can't quite control his emotions because he did lose a significant portion of his brain, the part that controls emotions. But he is a stirring example of what the Army likes to call resilience. I mean, he's among us, and he's a pretty amazing guy. He wanted to come see Adam Schumann. He was living by himself, a very, very lonely life, south of Atlanta. And one day he got on a plane and came to Kansas, and he and Adam Schumann spent the weekend together. And, you know, that was part of my reporting, to spend the weekend with them. And seeing the tenderness between these two somewhat lonesome, wounded men was just gorgeous, and as I said, heartbreaking as well. And underscoring everything was this maxim that the truth of war is that if you stay in war long enough, you're only in it for the guy next to you. But then when you come home, you're pretty much on your own. And that's the case. Despite Saskia's best efforts, Adam Schumann, in many ways, was living a lonely, isolated life. And so was Michael Emery. And when they got together, it was just a wonderful thing.
I want to talk about Adam's life going forward, but that tenderness, how did it exhibit itself as you spent that weekend with him?
Just in small ways. When Adam would go over to Emery's hotel room and he realized Emery couldn't really get dressed by himself. Adam just knelt down and helped put on his leg brace and tied his shoes and helped him get a shirt on and opened doors for him and closed doors for him. And it was a level of caring. The thing about this, Steve, is in both these books, the thing that was always so moving wasn't the horror of what they went through, wasn't the circumstances, but was again and again represented in the idea that even in these worst circumstances, people could act so decently toward mm-hmm. each other. Mm-hmm. It got me every time. And talk about a perfect example of it is the way Adam behaved toward Emery when he was incapable of acting that way toward himself, and then often his wife. It was just complicated and extraordinary and beautiful.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation with David Finkel about his new book, Thank You for Your Service. Again, it's the sequel to his first book, The Good Soldiers. David's a Pulitzer Prize winner. These books are just terrific reads, great reviews for both of them from so many different folks who have read these books. Let's talk about Adam's life going forward. Let's talk about how you managed to embed yourself with these men so effectively. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about 1913, the year before the Great War, you can find it and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a look at why progress for women is progress for all. We're visiting today with David Finkel of the Washington Post, who has two books out. We're talking about his latest book, Thank You for Your Service, hit the first book, The Good Soldiers. This latest book talks about the lives of men who returned to Fort Riley after fighting in the Iraqi surge and what their lives were like, how their lives turned based on the experiences, the harrowing experiences they went through in war. David Finkel is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize and also a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. Let's turn back to Adam Schumann, sort of the protagonist of this book, David, to the extent you have one here. He comes home and he's feeling what inside? How would you describe sort of, we talked in our first half about this moment where he fell asleep and dropped his own baby and he's feeling anguished about that. What's churning through him as he comes home and tries to readapt to life here back at home?
Well, I think it comes down to one word, which is shame. Mm-hmm. Whether it's justified or not, it didn't matter. He was feeling a sense of shame, which was drowning everything else out. The loudest voice in Adam's head was his own voice, and he was just feeling intense shame. And but it's not just him. It's so many people, and it's not just soldiers or ex-soldiers. It's family members as well. One thing I think it's fair to say after researching this book and the research basically meant spending a couple of years living with these folks. There's Adam and Saskia, a wonderful woman named Amanda Doster who lost her husband, a wonderful woman here named Christy Robinson also lost her husband. And all these people, there's just a little corner, at least, of some kind of guilt that overwhelms what could be a rational conversation that they didn't do anything wrong. They did fine. But I'm sorry,
guilt, David, because?
Well, everybody has their own reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the guy I was describing earlier, the guy who was blown up and saved two soldiers but didn't save one soldier, his dreams aren't about the two he saved. The dream, again and again, is about the one he didn't save. And I remember asking one day, do you ever dream about the guys you did save? He just... You know, he had the most rueful look on his face, and he said, that's not what dreams are about.
Hmm. Wow. But David, Adam isn't struggling just in general. He's going far, far down the road from that. He's having all kinds of suicidal thoughts, you know, loaded guns next to him as he's driving through the night. Again, tell us about that, what that's like for him.
Well, some days he did feel suicidal, but then some days he didn't feel suicidal. Right. And there's no predictable pattern. Something, again, as with any of these folks, it was hard to predict the triggers, hard to predict how a particular day would go. Things would be fine, and then they would just go a bit crazy in an instant. And you got the sense over time that these, just like in the war, when these guys went to the war, you know, it's fair to say that they didn't know what they were getting into. They were young guys. They were filled with a sense of mission. They were filled with a young man's sense of invincibility. Yeah. They were going to win the war. And then they lost their first guy, and then they lost their second guy, and then they began getting wounded, and war did to them what war always does. It became a life-changing, in many cases, a degrading experience.
You get the sense it's the cumulative effect of all these different experiences that tends to wear these people down.
It did wear them down in so many cases. And then they came home, and once again, they didn't quite know what they were getting into. You come home, you think everything's going to be okay. But when you come home from any war, it doesn't quite work out that way. And I think what any reader would pick up on is the sense that these lives have become reactive lives, that there's been the most basic loss of control. And what these folks are trying to do is swim their way back to some surface, some calm surface where they can begin to make sense of things. But day to day, whether it's a suicide attempt or thoughts of a suicide attempt or another soldier who I describe in the book, who the way he's getting through his days is to take 43 different pills every morning.
Yeah.
What's going on with all these folks? Or Saskia writing in her diary, or Amanda Doster, who lost her husband, making a decision to move out of her house. And the last place she saw her husband, the place she promised she would always be, and go to this new place. What's happening in all these cases is people just trying to scramble back to some kind of even surface.
And we're talking, in this case, about male soldiers, so I'm talking about the wives here, the women. Your heart just breaks for them because, as you describe Saskia, she doesn't know what she's going to get from one day to the next, from one hour to the next when it comes to her own husband.
No, and he doesn't know what he's going to get from her. I mean, it's Adam's not the only one suffering here, and Adam's not the only one with a version of PTSD. Saskia goes through it as well, and so do all the families to some extent. And again, I want to emphasize that most people who experience these wars will tell you they're okay, but you know yeah. if you push them hard enough, a lot of them will say, even though they're not part of the 500,000, a lot will say, you know, it's a little tough some days. This was what they went through during their deployment is just how can anyone be part of such a thing and then come home thinking everything will be easy and smooth.
But yet our society, it seems to me, David, has been sort of trained based on what you said earlier, the wars in World War II and Vietnam, the two bigger, more recent ones, where the soldiers came home and questions weren't asked and life seemed to go on and any problems were largely covered up. And, you know, there is a sense, I think, that it's hard for our society to confront this idea that you're presenting so graphically here, that so many of these folks are struggling.
Right. Well, here's a way to get at that. You think of these guys were pretty normal guys, and then they were sent to war, which is the most extreme of human circumstances. And over 15 months, you sort of get used to living within those extreme circumstances. And then you get on a jet and you're back here in normal circumstances. But in your head, you're still in this extreme place.
Yeah.
And it's so it's a transition. And there's one part of the book where a soldier named Nick DeNino has to he's the one who goes to this program in Colorado for 4 weeks. And he goes into a pretty intense group therapy session one day with 20 other guys like him who are trying to feel better. And they're all describing horrible things. But the most interesting thing about it is they're all saying the same thing after their descriptions. What was I thinking? What was I doing? Because it made complete sense over there in the moment. And it did. But then they came home and slowly it dawns on them, you know, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Things like what?
Well, there was one guy who was describing finding a skeleton one day and picking up a thigh bone and pretending to take a bite out of it as if he's holding a turkey leg at Disney World.
Mm-hmm.
Took a picture, kind of funny, everybody laughed. And then he got home and he saw this picture and he thought, what was that? Who had I become? And in the case of Nick DeNino, good soldier, went over to war with a tattoo. The tattoo, if I'm recalling correctly, said unity and peace. That's Nick DeNino. And then as happens to him in the war, he punches his first Iraqi in the face, and then he throws his first Iraqi down some stairs. And then he's home breaking down and saying to his wife, you know, what kind of monster did I become? And you say that enough times, you're thinking about that question. And he needed to go into a program to try to find some answers. It shouldn't be a badge of shame.
Yeah.
That he needed to go into a program to figure these things out. That's not a shaming thing. These were, as I said, the most extreme circumstances. And you know, I care about these people. And after basically thinking about them, reporting on them, writing about them for 7 years now, and I do care about them. And I'm glad that some treatment options are available. They deserve that.
You know, as we're talking here, you're in Kansas City. Do you have plans to go out to Fort Riley? And I know you're going on part of your book tour will take you out to Manhattan. Are you going to see Adam and Saskia?
I'm going to see as many of these folks as want to see me. It's really up to them.
Mm-hmm.
The book has only been out for a couple weeks now. I sent everyone a copy, and beyond that, it's up to them to say whether they want to see me and talk to me.
What are you hearing about their reactions to the book? Have you heard yet?
I've heard a few. There's a guy in the book. He's the one who said to Adam, none of this would have happened if you were there. He's a really interesting guy. He lives not far from where I live in Washington, D.C. So I met him for dinner and gave him a copy of the book. And you have to understand, these books are works of journalism, and the ethics of journalism are that they can't see the thing until it's published. Otherwise, it puts them in the role of editor or censor of their own stories. Mm-hmm. And they knew this going into it. So the book is published. I bring them a copy, and maybe 1 or 2 in the morning, I get a text from him. I'm on chapter one. And then a few minutes later, my phone buzzes. There's another text. I'm laughing hysterically. And then another text. I can't seem to stop crying.
Mm.
And then another text a few minutes later. I don't think I'm going to make it to chapter two. So I don't know if he's made it to chapter two. And I'm still waiting to
hear from him. You haven't heard from him since.
I haven't. And I'm still waiting to hear from the other folks. I urge them to take their time. Because what the book does... It's very intimate. It's an emotional book. It's not a detached book in any way.
No, it's not.
It's a piece of reporting, but it shows, as I keep saying, ground level, what they're going through. I think it's amazingly brave of these folks to open up their lives to the extremes that they did. I mean, it's all there.
I want to ask about that in just a moment. Just a reminder to our listeners, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting this morning with Pulitzer Prize winner David Finkel. He's the author of Thank You for Your Service. It's a book that chronicles the lives of soldiers returning from the surge in Iraq. He's also written a book titled The Good Soldiers, about their combat duty overseas and what that experience was like. You know, I'm just as a fellow journalist, I'm just struck by the intimacy here, the level of detail that you were able to glean in putting these books together. You know, how did you do it? Even the therapy sessions, how did you get access to those moments? You're in the car with Adam Schumann as he's going from Fort Riley to Topeka, you know, with his wife, and they're going 80, and she's yelling at the slow-moving car in front of her, that kind of thing. How did you get this kind of access to these people?
Well, the type of journalism I do doesn't so much depend on visiting a story or doing interviews for a story. It depends on going somewhere and staying and just not knowing what's going to happen, if anything will happen, but just sticking around long enough for a story to emerge. So in the case of the Good Soldiers, I was in Baghdad with them, living with them for 8 months, and a month, 6 weeks at a time. Then I would take breaks. So you have to understand, even though the battalion commander said, come along, if you want to chronicle our corner of the year of the war, come along, and you'll have full access. Just because he said that didn't mean that the soldiers themselves wanted me there, that they knew what a reporter does. They have their own versions, their stereotypes of what a reporter is like, but that doesn't mean they know anything. And there were lots of rumors about me. That I had been hired by the commander to write his biography.
Wow.
Not true.
Wow.
That anything any soldier said to me, I would immediately run to the commander and tattle on them. Not true. But it didn't matter. It's not like I called them all together and say, here's how a journalist works. That wasn't going to get anywhere. So what happened is the fact that I stayed and stayed and stayed, I think I began gaining some credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I was there with them when some bad things happened and the smoke would clear and they would see at the edge of the scene me there with a notebook just taking notes, and that I didn't become a problem for them. Then over time, a lot of them began to understand what a reporter does.
Mm-hmm.
So the credibility I got from that book is what I think allowed the intimacy of the second book. Look, I was with Schumann when he walked to the helicopter. When this guy, Tesolo Aieti, the guy who was blown up in a Humvee, when he was taken to the aid station, I was with him in the aid station. I was with him when he found out that the driver hadn't survived, had died. I was with these guys, and the families knew about it as well. And there's a certain credibility in that. So I was yards ahead when it was time for the second book. They knew my work. They knew the way I operated, and when I contacted them and said, here's what I want to do for the second book, I haven't finished the story yet. What's going on now? This is the crucial part of the story, and I want to write about what you're going through. They all thought about it, and they all said yes.
You know, it just strikes me, again, as a fellow journalist, that the ride you went on, at least initially, was such a lonely one. I mean, here you are just hanging out, trying to gain access, you know, trying to, you know, ingratiate yourself in some ways with these people and get to know them. And I'm sure it took a while. And that's a lonely ride, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. It was lonely at times. But let's have I think it's important to keep the larger thing in mind. These are significant wars.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, that corner of the war had not been documented. Would not be part of the archives of what people are going to look at these wars years from now. What was that thing? What went on? The policy books had been done. The high altitude books had been done. Some memoirs were starting to come out, but there hadn't been this journalistic deep dive into the far effects of policy, just the day-to-day life of a soldier, without judgment, without agenda. Not a book to say war is good or war is bad, or the surge was good or the surge was bad. Just here's what happens to a young man when he is sent into a war that's presumed to have reached its tragic moment. That was the illuminating thing for me. What happens to a young man when he's sent into any war at such a presumed lost moment? And then when they came home, this book published, and when they came home and started contacting me and saying, you know, I'm not doing so well. I thought everything was going to be okay, but I'm feeling a little anxious. I'm feeling a little depressed. I began hearing of suicide attempts. You know, it became clear to me that as good as I might have felt about the first book, I had told half the story, and the other half ought to be done. And for whatever reason, I had the credibility, and I had the privilege of being the one to try to do it.
How did you handle the war and what you saw? What impact did it have on you?
Well, you know, it rattled me, of course. When at the end of their deployment, it was April 10th, 2008, and when the last group of guys was standing in a field waiting for the last helicopters to come in to take them out of this place, which over the previous 2 weeks had just gone all to hell. For reasons that had nothing to do with them, the war reasserted itself in the ugliest way for the final 2 weeks of their deployment. They should have been packing up to go home. Instead, it was just flat-out fighting. And it was time for them to leave. And we're all in an open field and waiting for the last helicopters to come in. And I had reached the point where I wasn't being a very good reporter. It was hard for me. I was scared. You know, I was just rattled, man. And waiting and watching the horizon for the helicopters, but then also seeing at the same time, I'm not seeing helicopters. I'm seeing an approaching dust storm. And if the dust gets here before the helicopters, I'm stuck in this place for 3 or 4 more days. It was a depressing moment for me. And when the helicopters came in and I got on board and the last guys left, I was pretty happy in that moment.
You know, how ready do you think the country is to read this book? You know, we were talking about the fact that a lot of people describe this book, Thank You for Your Service, as an important book, and maybe you recoil a little bit from that adjective. What about that?
Well, I worry about that. If the book is being presented as this is something you must read, it sounds like a dose of medicine.
It's a homework assignment or something.
And that's not the way I intend this. I don't know how this book will be received. I know the reviews have been good. I know I'm getting nice emails so far. But I don't know how willing people are to read stories of what the afterwar is like. To me, that's not... Just like the first book wasn't about the Iraq War, it was about the character of young men being sent into any war at such a moment. This book is to me, these are really amazing people. Mm-hmm. And I think very quickly, if you start reading the book, very quickly you're gonna like them, and you're gonna want to know what they're going through and what happened to them. And if people do read the book, I'm not naive enough to think that a book like this is going to do anything grand like affect war policy, but it might affect how people think about what's going on across the country right now. And you know what it does? It might help put really good faces to these numbers that are becoming blurry. 500,000 people, 12 years of war, $1 billion spent by DOD last year on mental health, which was double 2007. We hear it all the time, and you hear numbers enough time, and it just becomes meaningless in a way. So read this book, meet these people, feel about them like I feel about them, and then when you hear the numbers, you'll be thinking about these folks.
In The Good Soldiers, you were just talking a minute ago about what you learned about the character of young men going into war. What did you learn? I mean, how do you summarize what you picked up there?
To watch these young men transition from such a sense of invincibility to coming home, not defeated, but definitely degraded and changed. That was quite stunning to see. And even though, you know, in theory, from having read, I know this is what war does, because this is what war always does. Nonetheless, these are our wars. These are our young men and women going into them. Yeah. And this is happening now. So war may always do this, but you know what happened here? It did it again. And here they are home.
Now, I couldn't help but notice, David, that Steven Spielberg, no less a personage than Steven Spielberg, has purchased the rights to this latest book, Thank You for Your Service. What kind of film does he have in mind, and what role are you going to have in it?
I have no idea. Here's what I'm allowed to say about this.
Yes.
I have read in the trade papers that Steven Spielberg may be interested in this book.
Yeah.
But no, there's nothing. I mean, there's nothing solid here.
Well, it's kind of neat, though. Maybe.
Kind of neat, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think let me get dreamy for a minute and think that a lot of people read this book. And I'll be grateful for that. But the big hope here is that as many people pay specific attention to what's going on as possible, so that when they say, "Thank you for your service," the title of this book, it won't come across as some kind of safe thing to say. They'll actually know some of the people they're thanking and some of the things they're thanking them for. So I've written a book, and a book can only reach so many people. But if this guy makes a movie, oh, man,
look out.
The story really gets out there. Right. So I've got my fingers crossed.
You named this, you titled this book, "Thank You for Your Service." Why?
Well, not to be ironic or to judgmental or bitter. It really is that reason. It's a ubiquitous phrase by now. People just say it all the time. I think between the covers of this book are the stories of the people we're thanking and some of the things we're thanking them for. It's that simple. Here's who you're thanking, and here's what you're saying thank you for.
Is there a third book here?
Well, I would like there to be. I don't know. Like I said, I've been living this story for 7 years, and as far as I'm concerned, it's the important work of my lifetime, and I'm reluctant to walk away from it. But once you've written a story about guys go to war, and then you've written the second volume, now they're home from war. I'm not sure what the third volume is.
David Finkel is the author of "Thank You for Your Service." It's just been a pleasure.
Thanks so much
for coming in, David. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve.
You can find more information about all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, I'll look at why progress for women is progress for all. The show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.